You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Boston College. Today is Sunday, August 9th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a clear reminder for every listener joining us now. The perspectives you hear today belong solely to our hosts and guests. They rise from their lived experience, their research, and their commitment to speaking truth without hesitation. They do not represent the official views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. In this space, nothing is softened, nothing is filtered, nothing is shaped to satisfy institutions or protect comfort. What you hear belongs to the people who speak it, fully, directly, and without apology. And with that clarity set firmly before us, we begin. This Week in Palestine is not a place where truth hesitates. It does not knock politely or wait for permission to enter. Here, truth steps forward with its spine straight, its voice unshaken, and its presence impossible to ignore. Urgency is not decoration in this space. It is the pulse behind every sentence, every report, every breath taken at this microphone. Clarity is not optional. It is the obligation we accept the moment we speak. And while our heart beats in Palestine, in the alleys of Jerusalem, in the camps of the West Bank, in the shattered streets of Gaza, our vision reaches far beyond the borders carved by occupation or diplomacy. Because the forces shaping Palestinian life do not stop at checkpoints or concrete walls. They move through parliaments, through corporate boardrooms, through the quiet corridors where powerful hands make decisions that ordinary people must live with. Wherever you are listening now, driving through the long hours of your shift, lifting your first cup of coffee into the morning light, or sitting in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I am your host and narrator, Arlene Russell. In this space, we do not file down the edges of truth to make it easier to swallow. We do not bend the story to comfort those who prefer silence. We do not dilute reality for anyone's convenience. Here, truth stands unfiltered. Resistance is not fury. It is breath. It is survival. Solidarity is not a slogan. It is a lineage carried from one generation to the next. The voices rising from occupied land do not tremble. They rise beside movements across the world demanding dignity, justice, and liberation. They remind us that struggle is never isolated. It is woven across borders, across histories, across the lives of people who refuse to surrender their humanity. This hour is not simply a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth reaching for. Even in the deepest darkness, the spark of defiance survives. Even when the world turns away, that spark refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, complexity, and unbroken courage. We speak with intention because the stakes demand nothing less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite silence. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. The struggle for freedom is shared, it crosses borders, and it remains sacred. Today, we step into a conversation that exposes the raw nerves of a nation, the aggression of the settlers, and the political narratives shaping the conflict. A conversation hosted by Piers Morgan, a British broadcaster known for confrontational interviews and unfiltered debate. His panel brings together voices that rarely share the same stage.
Daniela Weiss, a prominent Zionist settler activist who advocates for expanding Israeli settlements across the West Bank.
Binny Morris, a Zionist historian whose work on Israel's founding has sparked global controversy and debate. Munther Isaac, a Palestinian pastor from Bethlehem who speaks about the lived reality of occupation and the moral weight of justice. Norman Finkelstein, an American political scientist and author known for his sharp critiques of Israeli policy and his extensive research on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Together, they confront a moment that has shaken the region: Israeli settlers rampaging through Palestinian towns. This is not a polite discussion. It is not softened. It is not designed to protect anyone's comfort. It is designed to reveal the contradictions, fears, and political machinery driving the conflict today. Part 1. We Are Terrified, The Settler Panic. Now, let's try to understand the fear that has taken hold among Israeli settlers. In recent weeks, settlers have launched violent rampages across Palestinian villages in the West Bank. Homes burned, cars torched, families forced to flee. Videos show masked settlers marching with rifles, chanting threats, and attacking civilians. Israeli human rights groups describe these attacks as organized, not spontaneous. Palestinians describe them as terror. Daniela Weiss insists settlers are acting out of fear. She says they are terrified, living under constant threat, surrounded by enemies. She argues that settlers must defend themselves, that their presence is divinely mandated, and that Palestinian resistance is proof that coexistence is impossible. But today, we must ask, what does fear look like when it becomes a justification for violence? What happens when fear becomes a political tool? Let's see how this fear is shaped. Settlers live in fortified enclaves, protected by the Israeli military. They carry weapons, they travel in armored vehicles, they receive state funding, infrastructure, and political backing, yet they describe themselves as vulnerable, besieged, and abandoned. This fear is not only emotional, it is ideological. It is cultivated through education, religious narratives, and political rhetoric that frame Palestinians as existential threats. It is reinforced by leaders who portray settlement expansion as both a right and a necessity. But fear does not erase responsibility. Fear does not justify rampage. Fear does not excuse collective punishment. Munther Isaac counters Weiss's narrative with lived experience. He describes Palestinian families who endure settler attacks without protection, without recourse, without justice. He speaks of children who wake to smoke and gunfire, of parents who stand guard at night with nothing but their bodies to shield their homes. Today, we confront the reality that fear is not exclusive. Fear belongs to Palestinians, too. Fear belongs to those who have no army, no state, no protection. Part 2, Binny Morris and his fairy tales of the historical narrative. Now, let's try to understand how history is used to justify the present. Binny Morris, one of Israel's most controversial historians, argues that violence is inevitable. He claims that Palestinians have always rejected coexistence, that Israel's founding required force, and that today's conflict is a continuation of historical patterns. His narrative is stark. Israel fights because it must. Palestinians resist because they refuse to accept reality. Violence is tragic, but unavoidable. But today, we must ask, who defines inevitability? Who decides which history matters? Who benefits from a narrative that portrays violence as destiny? Morris's framing often erases Palestinian agency, Palestinian suffering, and Palestinian rights. It reduces the conflict to a cycle without accountability. It suggests that settlement expansion, military occupation, and displacement are natural outcomes of history rather than political choices. Norman Finkelstein challenges this directly. He argues that history is not destiny. He insists that political decisions, not fate, shape the conflict. He points to documented evidence of land seizures, discriminatory laws, and systematic violence. He argues that invoking history to justify present-day oppression is a political strategy, not a historical truth. Today, we confront the fact that history can be weaponized. History can be selective. History can be used to absolve power. Part 3, Hamas Arms Deals, the Political Shockwave. Now let's see how the conversation shifts when the topic turns to Hamas. New reports reveal that Hamas has acquired weapons through regional networks, smuggling routes, and covert deals. These revelations have sparked outrage, fear, and political maneuvering. Israeli officials claim these deals prove Hamas is preparing for long-term conflict. Palestinians argue that armed resistance is a response to decades of occupation. Piers Morgan presses the panel. Does Hamas's access to weapons justify Israel's actions? Does it explain settler violence? Does it excuse collective punishment? Norman Finkelstein responds with precision. He argues that focusing solely on Hamas's weapons obscures the broader reality. Gaza remains under siege, Palestinians remain occupied, and resistance, armed or otherwise, emerges from conditions created by Israeli policy. He does not defend violence, he contextualizes it. Munther Isaac adds a moral dimension. He argues that violence cannot be understood without acknowledging the structural violence Palestinians endure daily. He insists that peace can't be built on fear, militarization, or dehumanization. Daniela Weiss rejects these arguments. She insists Hamas's weapons justify harsher Israeli measures. She argues that Palestinians must be eliminated before peace is possible. But today, we must ask, does militarization justify occupation? Does resistance justify rampage? Does fear justify erasure? Part 4, The Battle Over Truth. Now, let's try to understand the heart of this debate. This conversation is not simply about settlers or Hamas. It is about truth. Who defines it, who controls it, and who pays the price when truth becomes dangerous. Piers Morgan pushes each guest to confront contradictions. Weiss defends criminals and settlers. Morris defends fake history. Isaac defends humanity. Finkelstein defends evidence. Their clash reveals a deeper reality. The conflict is not only fought on land. It is fought through narratives. It is fought through fear. It is fought through memory. Today, we confront a truth that cannot be ignored. Violence does not emerge from a vacuum. Fear does not justify rampage. History does not absolve oppression. Weapons do not erase rights. Part 5, What Now? Now, let's see where this leaves us. Israeli settlers say they are terrified. Palestinians say they are terrorized. Historians say violence is inevitable. Pastors say justice is possible. Scholars say truth is being buried. This conversation forces us to confront the uncomfortable reality that fear, ideology, and political narratives shape the conflict as much as weapons and borders do. Today, we step into that discomfort. Today, we examine the claims. Today, we confront the contradictions. Today, we listen to voices that rarely share the same stage. This is not just a debate.
It is a mirror. It reflects the fear, the anger, the history, and the humanity at the center of the conflict. And now, let's listen together.
Are you and your supporters ethnically cleansing the West Bank?
We want the Jewish state to be for Jews.
From Daniela Weiss at one end of the spectrum to Benny Morris at the other end of the spectrum.
The expulsion of the population in the West Bank and in Gaza is deeply rooted in Zionist ideology.
It sounds like a self-hating Jew, Norman Finkelstein.
Benny Morris described the Palestinians as, quote, a sick, psychotic people.
The Palestinians certainly behaved in a psychotic way during the second Intifada.
Unfortunately, it has become a nation of child killers.
Israeli officials were quick to revel in Spain's embarrassment as tens of thousands of migrants poured across the Moroccan border into its territory last week. Ambassador Danny Danon said maybe before it continues lecturing us, it's time it explained to the world why it still maintains colonial enclaves in Africa. Well, many people felt this was a pot kettle black moment. Israel and the US both loudly back the Moroccan claim to Western Sahara, where many indigenous groups say the occupying Moroccans are, well, colonists. And the Israeli government has done little or nothing to stop the violent expansion of settlements in the West Bank, where a major crisis has been quietly unfolding for months. Security Minister Ben-Gvir has encouraged the settlers. In fact, he says he wants Israelis to colonise Gaza next. The BBC recently visited the settlements and got a glimpse of why violence is taking over.
Sounds like you're saying one Jewish life mm-hmm. is worth hundreds or thousands of Palestinian lives.
Not a million. One Jewish life, it's 10 million, okay?
That just sounds racist.
Yes. I know.
Well, Daniela Weiss, who's the founder of Nachala, is often called the godmother of Israeli settlers, and she joins me now. Welcome back to Uncensored, Daniela Weiss. We just saw a clip from the BBC report in the West Bank interviewing Yehuda Shimon, a lawyer with an organisation that represents Israelis arrested for violence against Palestinians. Now, when a top Israeli lawyer says on camera to the BBC that one Jewish life is worth 10 million Palestinian lives and says he knows it's racist to say that, it feels pretty outrageous to the rest of us watching. Were you outraged by what he said or did you agree with him?
It's an expression that I did not use, so you should ask him about it. And I am responsible for my expressions. So this is not the kind of sentence that I would use.
Would you say that a Jewish life is worth exactly the same as a Palestinian life? That one life is worth the same as another?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the full sentence or the full question. Could you please ask it again?
Would you say, therefore, that one Jewish life is worth the same as one Palestinian life?
It's not, I just said it, but I'm ready to say it again. I know that according to my religion, human beings were created. The human being, the first Adam, was created by God, and all human beings were the result of this creation. So why do you bring me into this channel of comparing one to the other? I respect people of other nations, people of other religions. The only situation where things clash is when other religions, people of other religions or other nations clash with us, with Israel or with Jews. I don't see us attacking others or clashing with others unless they start. And I think it's a well-known thing. So I don't know what corner you are in now. I really don't understand.
Just to be clear,
the Jewish religion.
Just to be right, but just to be clear, somebody else that follows your religion, Yehuda Shimon, who's a lawyer with a big organization that represents Israelis arrested for violence against Palestinians. He is the one that said a Jewish life is worth 10 million Palestinian lives. I think it's interesting and notable that you don't agree with him, okay, but I'm just asking you in the context of what he said.
I didn't know about I don't know the person. And if you want to dwell on this, it's your decision. I have so many things to think about.
I'm going to come to other issues, I guarantee you. This is not why we got you on the program, but it is a story that's happened in the last few days. It has caused a lot of outrage. I think it's notable that you don't agree with what he said, but I just want to be quite clear.
No, I don't.
But just to be... No, but am I right in concluding that you believe a Jewish life is worth the same as a Palestinian life, and a Palestinian life is worth the same as a Jewish life? Do you agree with that statement?
I tried to listen to the previous item of your program. It was about men and women. So like what you're asking now about Jews and other people, it reminds me like comparing between a man and a woman. Each individual has his characteristics, his nature, and what is the point of this comparison? I'm a woman.
I don't understand why you can't just give me a straight answer.
I am, and you're proud of what you are. A Jew is proud to be a Jew, and a Muslim is proud to be a Muslim. So what's this comparison?
I understand.
And especially.
Let me help you.
I explained to you that I didn't know about it.
Let me help you. Let me help you. Let me help you understand. Let me help you understand, because you're clearly struggling with this. I think my life is worth the same as your life, and your life is worth the same as mine. I'm a Catholic, an Irish Catholic.
Right.
You are an Israeli Jew. All right? I think we're both worth exactly the same. I've asked you twice, and I'll only ask you one more time, but would you agree that a Jewish life is worth the same as a Palestinian life? Yes or no?
I know that you like yes or no question answers.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, yes or no
question. It's a very simple question.
But I think that it is like a question, like a question that refers to differences between sexes. What is more, woman or man? Say yes or no.
Well, it's not though, is it?
It's not the same.
It's not the same. It's not the same because you're a woman and I'm a man, but I think we're both worth exactly the same, right? A man is worth the same as a woman. A woman is worth the same as a man. So I'm just struggling to understand why you can't just say a Jewish life is worth the same as a Palestinian life. Would you agree with that?
I think that all human beings
are the same. I know, you've said that several times.
But the point is why you came to this point, why you're asking me this question. It's on the basis of some clash.
I just told you why.
So what?
Daniela Weiss, I told you why. Because a senior Israeli lawyer says that a Jewish life is worth 10 million Palestinian lives. I told you why.
I don't understand why you keep talking about
gender and everything else. I'm like, look, it's a very simple question. Do you think a Jewish life is worth the same as a Palestinian life? Yes or no? You either do or you don't.
I think that all human beings were created by God. This fact you said many times. Itself shows that all human beings are the same.
So is a Jewish life worth the same as a Palestinian life? Yes or no?
No, you will ask the same question and I will give the same answer.
Why don't you want to say yes or no?
Chaviv, in Hebrew we say Chaviv Adam shenivra betzelem. The nature of our flesh and blood, the nature of this creation is that it is God's creation. Why do you want me to extend on this? Because of clashes?
I just want you to answer a simple question. But look, I've tried three... With respect, I've asked you three times a very simple question. You choose not to answer. That's your prerogative. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, but viewers can make their own minds up. Let's turn to what's happening on the West Bank. Amnesty International has accused Israel of orchestrating a campaign of ethnic cleansing against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. That's in a report published in June. It claimed the forced displacement was a result of deliberate state policy rather than actions of individual settlers. Are you and your supporters ethnically cleansing Palestinians from the West Bank?
The thing that I do, and people from my movement, Nahala, and the activists and the settlers all over, what we do, we establish communities, many communities on government property, which is on millions of dunams. And I can say with much satisfaction that in the last 2 years, more than 100 new communities were established over Judea and Samaria. You call it occupied or West Bank. It's the birthplace of my nation, of our nation. I am so proud to sit here and to say in your program that I am so happy that after the terrible massacre of the 7th of October and going so down in our history, we overcame and we really managed to create a situation in Judea and Samaria that the Oslo Accords are over and Palestinian state is over. And this is really what preoccupies my mind, and not who is better and who is a Jew and who is not a Jew. What busies my mind is that the Jewish nation fulfills its vision in the heart of our homeland. This is where I am. And you know me already. It's not the first time that we exchange thoughts and questions and answers. This is my one preoccupation, to fulfill the word of God that he said to Abraham, come, go on a high hill, see the land, walk through the land, and build the land. And this is what I do. All the other things are...
No, I understand. The problem is you're seizing and taking land, which... Yeah, the trouble is you're seizing and taking properties that belong to Palestinians. The United Nations data indicates that more than 100 West Bank... Let me finish my point. The UN data indicates that more than 100 West Bank villages were fully or partially emptied between January 2023 and April 2026. Last week, the UN's Human Rights Office warned that violence in the West Bank is worsening. As of 20th of July, 18 Palestinians have died this year in attacks involving settlers. There were 190 attacks per month in the first 4 months of this year. If that trend continues, then it will lead to more than 2,000 attacks by the end of the year. The number of settler attacks has increased each year since 2023, following October the 7th, rising to 1,835 last year. So it's very clear what's been going on. And that is that Israeli settlers have been rampaging around the West Bank, taking property that is occupied by Palestinians. And that is a crime, as you know. It is illegal, and it is condemned by most of the rest of the world. So my question again to you is your intention to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from the West Bank? If, as you say, this is your homeland, then presumably you would like to get rid of every Palestinian from the West Bank. You want them all gone, yes?
I see we clash again. The way you express things and the way I express it, of course, from my point of view and from the point of view that you represent at this specific instant. What we do in the land of Israel, and of course on the mountain ridge, is returning from the diaspora after long years of dispersion And we are building the land that was wasteland at the end of the Ottoman Empire. This is what we do. And the things that you bring here, one number and another number, do not represent the positive, Zionistic success of redeeming the land that was desolate when we were not here. This is the real history of modern Zionism. We came to a land that was deserted, and we made it paradise. And the best proof for it is that Arabs from all over the Middle East want very much to come and to be part of this party. And this clashes sometimes with our vision and our plan to establish a state for the Jews and not for Arabs from all over the Middle East.
Right, but your pride in what you're doing, yes, I disagree with your pride in what you're doing, because actually what Israeli settlers are doing in the West Bank is they are breaking...
You disagree with what?
I'm about to tell you that Israeli settlers are breaking the law by taking and rampaging through Palestinian homes, and they are removing Palestinians from their homes. They are, in some cases, killing Palestinians, setting fire to their homes, and they are seizing property and land that is not theirs. That is a crime. So you are perpetrating many, many crimes on the West Bank,
Pierce,
which is an obscenity.
We speak so
Why
much
are you doing
on the on the program. Listen to me. Listen to me. We speak so much. I invite you to be with me. I'm a very good guide for Judea and Samaria. You can see with your own eyes how the size of property that is still to establish settlements on. Plenty of government property. We do not have to cause any harm to any individual in order to
continue building the Jewish state. You are causing harm. Come along, you will see it with your own eyes. Daniela Weiss, you are causing enormous harm. 18 Palestinians have been killed. There are 190 attacks per month in the first 4 months of this year. You are attacking Palestinians almost every single day. So you are causing enormous harm to Palestinians in the West Bank. And many people believe that your real plan is to get rid of all the Palestinians from the West Bank ultimately Gaza too. Would you like Palestinians to all be removed from the West Bank?
No, this is not the attitude of my religion. As a Jew, I go by the Bible, and I go by Joshua's, the biggest settler ever, by his laws. The people who live in Israel and accept Israeli sovereignty can live. Those who fight us, we fight. Those who do not accept the fact that in the land of Israel, the Jews are the only government, the only sovereign, they cannot stay. So either you accept our sovereignty, if you fight us, we fight, and if you do not accept it, you just, item before my your interview with me was about Morocco coming to Spain, if I'm not mistaken, but it was a bit not clear, but this is this issue is going on. So every country wants, every nation wants her country to be country for the people of this nation. And I don't understand how you came to such a confusion about it. We want the Jewish state to be for Jews. It is such an obvious, such a clear, such a universal acceptance. So, I repeat
the problem is, it's obvious to you. It's not obvious to the rest of the world who perceive what you're doing in the West Bank to be crimes. But we're going to leave it there. Daniela Weiss, thank you for coming back on Uncensored. Well, joining me now is a Palestinian Christian pastor, Munta Isaac. Munta Isaac, welcome to Uncensored.
Thank you for having me, of course.
What is your reaction to that interview with Daniela Weiss? Because from where I was sitting here listening to that, it seems to me pretty clear what her intentions are on the West Bank. But the problem with that is that the Israeli settlers are rampaging around, grabbing any Palestinian homes that they can get their hands on, which is a crime.
Yeah, don't listen to me. Listen to the settler leaders themselves. Listen to Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and others. They've called it, we need to encourage Palestinians to leave. We need to encourage Palestinians to migrate. That has been the Zionist plan since the very beginning. And it has certainly accelerated since this government took over. But the building of settlements is not a new endeavor. What we're witnessing today is an unprecedented violence that takes several forms. Of course, the death of Palestinians is what's being reported. But beyond that, it's arsons, it's burning homes, burning trees, uprooting trees, burning mosques, it's polluting water. They're doing everything they can to encourage Palestinians to leave these villages. And as you said, they managed to succeed to empty many communities. That's obviously the plan that they state. And unfortunately, because of the silence and impunity of Israel enjoys in the international community, the plan continues.
And just to be clear, what they're doing is criminal.
What they're doing is horrific. We're afraid for our lives. Every time I drive on outside of the Palestinian-controlled areas, the cities, and of course, even within the Palestinian cities, I'm in Ramallah now, and we see the Israeli military all the time. But whenever I drive with roads that we know settlers are around, I'm afraid for my life. We live in constant fear from what they're doing. And Palestinians are defenseless. We can't defend ourselves. And when Palestinians try to defend themselves, the settlers enjoy the protection of the Israeli military. And that's why I think we need to continue to emphasize that it's not the problem of radical settlers as if they are outlaws and the government can't control them. The military protects them. The military accompanies them. And they are helping implement the plan of the current government of Israel and many governments before that to annex more and more land from the West Bank. And when we say annexing the land, they want the land, the geography, but they don't want people in it. And that's why the government allows these attacks to happen with the hope that they succeed in pushing more and more Palestinians outside of their towns, their communities, their villages, while, of course, making empty statements to the international community that they condemn these attacks. But we know that they're doing nothing to stop them. Actually, they're protecting these settlers. Your previous guest invited you to come. I invite you to come and see the horror Palestinians in villages live in on every single day. And I invite you to come and listen to the stories of horror that has been well documented and that has been allowed to continue day after day after day.
Yeah, well, I see the reports and I see the footage. I don't need to see it for myself. It's being widely reported. I think it's indisputable what's happening. Now, you yourself have been quite a controversial figure. The Jewish Insider described you as the high priest of anti-Semitic Christianity after an interview you did with Tucker Carlson in 2024. They claim that on October the 8th, the day after the appalling terror attacks of October the 7th, you said in your sermon, what is happening is an embodiment of the injustice that has befallen us as Palestinians from the Nakba until now. Anyone following the events was not surprised by what happened yesterday. One of the scenes that left an impression on my mind yesterday, and there are many scenes, is the scene of the Israeli youth who were celebrating a concert in the open air, the Nova Music Festival, just outside the borders of Gaza, and how they escaped. What a great contradiction between the besieged poor on the one hand and the wealthy people celebrating as if there was nothing behind the wall. Gaza exposes the hypocrisy of the world. Now, do you stand by those comments? Because many people felt that they were effectively trying to justify Hamas slaughtering 1,200 Israelis, including hundreds of young people at the music festival.
Yeah, thank you for asking me about that, Pierce. Because these words were said the day after the attacks, when what was reported is that we didn't know the exact numbers. No one fathomed that 1,200 people were killed, and we didn't know that a massacre took place in the music festival. And I certainly condemn the killing of civilians, innocent civilians in their homes, or the kidnapping of children. Nothing I said condones or justifies violence. I'm trying to explain what happens. And namely, that the attacks happened as the aftermath of a brutal, brutal siege. In fact, Pierce, if you look at my talks, my writings over the years, I've been consistent in believing in nonviolence and in believing that every life is worth the same. All lives are equal. Every life matters to God. All of us are created in God's image. And that's why I've never believed that violence solves things. At the same time, when we try to explain to people, you know, so much has been said about the horrific events of October 7th and their impact on the psyche of the Israeli society. Now, imagine how many October 7th did the Palestinians endure over their lives. And that's what I was trying to explain, that the people of Gaza have seen enough, and all of a sudden we thought they were rebelling against their siege. But honestly, we didn't realize how much innocent people were killed that day. And we've been consistent in saying, not just we believe in nonviolence as Palestinian Christians myself, but also that, you know, even if you believe in resistance, you can't justify killing innocent civilians in their homes. And I hope that everyone agrees with us, because that has been our cry since Israel's retaliation, the genocidal war that happened since October 7th against the people of Gaza, which continues today.
So would you unreservedly condemn what Hamas did on October the 7th?
When it comes to killing civilians and kidnapping children and families and going home to home and shooting, or what happened in the music festivals, yes, I can't condone that as a man of faith, absolutely. But when it comes to Palestinians' right to resist their occupiers, that's what we as Palestinians emphasize. This is what the international law guarantees us, as long as, you know, we don't target civilians. And as I said, I'm even against violence itself.
Right, well, that's good to hear. I think that's what we need. We need to hear people on all sides condemning the violence when it occurs. And there's been way too much violence generally going on in that part of the world now for many, many, many years, decades. I appreciate you joining me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pierce. Thank you.
Well, joining me to debate this is author and political scientist Norman Finkelstein and historian and Professor Benny Morris. Well, welcome to both of you. Norman Finkelstein, welcome back to Uncensored. This whole issue of what is going on the West Bank, you know, I've had Daniela Weiss saying that this is merely a case of Jewish people reclaiming their land, nothing to see here, nothing criminal, they're not doing harm to anybody. But we've just heard from a Palestinian Christian pastor who says the complete opposite, and certainly from the news footage we've seen, it's quite clear that Israeli settlers have been waging a campaign of terror on the West Bank now for a considerable period of time, which most of the international community views as criminal activity. What is your view of what is happening on the West Bank?
My view on what's happening in the West Bank is basically this, that the expulsion of the population in the West Bank and in Gaza is deeply rooted in Zionist ideology. As Benny Morris himself wrote, the idea of transfer, which is just a euphemism for expulsion, the idea of transfer is inherent and inbuilt in the idea of Zionism. And as Benny Morris himself said, the problem with the Israelis, or the problem with David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, the problem with him was that, quote, he didn't complete the job. That's what Mr. Morris said. And also, Mr. Morris has written that
That's a tiny spot of land, and there's no room, I'm quoting him, there's no room for two peoples in that land, and that there should be only one people there, one state, a Jewish state. So all of that is not new, but as your previous guest stated, there has been an escalation since October 7th, and that was pretty predictable. Because, as you know, the cliche, every crisis is also an opportunity. And the Israeli cabinet, not unlike, by the way, my own American government after 9/11, they shed some salty tears. Here I refer both to my government and the Israeli government. They shed some salty tears after the massacres and then rubbed their palms in glee. Here is an opportunity. In the case of my own government, the opportunity was first Afghanistan, then they thought Iraq, then they thought Syria, then they thought Iran. That was their plan, to exploit to the maximum 9/11. In the same way, Israel, since October 7th, yes, the salty tears were shed, and then they rubbed their palms in glee. Here is a unique opportunity. And the unique opportunity was first to solve the Gaza question once and for all. And the way they wanted to solve it was a massive expulsion. The means to achieve that massive expulsion was genocidal. And then they proceeded to eliminate Hezbollah, or they thought they eliminated Hezbollah. And now they're trying also in the West Bank. And of course, the big target was Iran. And there too, Benny Morris, for years, literally every couple of years, he would write an op-ed saying two things. Number one, Israel has to attack Iran. And number two, if the United States doesn't join in, Israel has no option except to use non-conventional, i.e. nuclear weapons. So the claim, the presumptions of Daniela Weiss are shared across the Israeli spectrum. Benny Morris described the Palestinians as, quote, a sick, psychotic people, quoting him. So the presumptions, the assumptions of Daniela Weiss, they may sound radical to an American viewer, but they are typical of Israeli society, from Daniela Weiss at one end of the spectrum to Benny Morris, who was once Israel's leading historian, at the other end of the spectrum. Just one last word. If you look at the current UN report on the deliberate killing of Palestinian children, they describe many scenes of the settlers. A group of settlers urinating on a child. A group of settlers kidnapping a 4 and 5 year old child, brother and sister, and tying them to a tree. A bunch of Israeli soldiers, not settlers, soldiers attacking a 16 year old who is hearing impaired and kicking him on the ground. And then a group of soldiers attacking a fellow, shooting him. He's on the ground pleading for help. The soldiers stand around laughing, filming the scene, and blocking any medical aid for him. The soldiers. Remember, Israel is a citizen army. The soldiers are representative of Israeli society, just like Daniela Weiss at one end of the spectrum and Benny Morris at the other end is representative of Israeli society. It is, unfortunately, it has become a nation of child killers.
Benny Morris, your response to that?
Well, it sounds like a self-hating Jew, Norman Finkelstein, And the woman, Daniela Weiss, is obviously a religious, a messianic fanatic. I don't think either of them should represent anyone, and they certainly don't speak the truth about most Israelis, as Finkelstein would have it. The Israeli settlers in the West Bank, many of them, are behaving illegally, and the government is going along with them and protecting them in various ways, certainly not prosecuting them for committing these crimes more or less on a daily basis in the West Bank, because they ultimately support eventual annexation of the West Bank, and they believe that removing small communities of shepherds serves that purpose, this annexationist purpose. And I, of course, and I think at least half of the Israelis don't agree with this. It doesn't represent the Israeli public, as Ms. Weiss, who's, as I say, a fanatic, doesn't as well. I did use the phrase psychotic, and the Palestinians certainly behaved in a psychotic way during the second Intifada, when they exploded bombs in buses and in streets and killed over 1,000 Israelis during that second Intifada, that rebellion in 2001, 2002, 2003. But I wouldn't call the Palestinians in general psychotic, but they have behaved very poorly. They're very poorly led. They're divided between one fanatical movement, which is misogynist, the Hamas, misogynist, homosexual, anti-homosexual, homophobic, Jew-hating, they're anti-Semitic, and they hate the West in general, much like the rest of the Islamic Islamist world. And here we have a problem which Finkelstein doesn't seem to understand, that the war in Gaza was the first step in an Islamist, pan-Islamic war against the Jewish state, dedicated to eradicating the Jewish state. The Hamas began on the October 7th. The Hezbollah of Lebanon began the next day from Lebanon. And eventually the Houthis in Yemen and the Iranians from Iran itself all attacked successively the Jewish state. And Israel is surrounded by the Islamists who want to destroy the Jewish state. The Jewish state, Israel, doesn't say it wants to destroy the Islamic world or Iran or Lebanon, but this is the way it is, and Israel has basically been defending itself. I don't like the Israeli government. I don't like the way it defends. It defends Israel. It's done so incompetently. I don't believe, incidentally, in expulsion. I've never said that the country between the river and the sea belongs only to one people. That's not my position. There are two peoples there, both with claims to the land, and it should be ideally divided between the two peoples in two states. That's the ideal solution. The Palestinians have always rejected it. Today's the Israeli government also rejects it, but most Israelis and many Israeli governments and the Zionist movements since 1937 has always agreed to partition and to two states between the river and the sea. Unfortunately, the Palestinians have always said no to this.
Okay, Norman Finkelstein, I want to play you a clip. This is from the Hamas spokesman, Ghazi Hamad, who came on Uncensored on Monday. Made a lot of news. Let's take a look.
Hamas as liberation organization, we never commit crimes. We never kill civilians. We try all the time to liberate our home from the
Well, that's complete nonsense, Mr. Hamad. I have to interrupt there. When you say you don't commit crimes and you don't kill innocent civilians, we all saw what happened on October the 7th in 2023. You had 3,000 members of your organization, Hamas, pour over the Israeli border and commit a series of despicable crimes in which you massacred innocent civilians all over Israel. You then captured over 250 of them, including Holocaust survivors and a baby. So the idea you've not committed crimes is ridiculous.
No. I say 100%, I'm confident that 100%. We never commit crimes against the civilians. Maybe some mistake happened, but it is not the police of Hamas. It is not the
Well, there weren't mistakes. You gunned down innocent people. Now, Norman, I mean, it is plainly ridiculous for the Hamas spokesman to try and pretend they didn't commit any crimes on October the 7th. I presume you would agree that's ridiculous.
Yes, I've said on several occasions, and here I'll echo your previous speaker, Montier, I guess his name is. Is that correct, his name? Mm. I don't want to mispronounce it.
Munter, yeah. I'm not sure quite how the local pronunciation is, yeah.
Yeah. He said, when you quoted him from his sermon right after October 7th, he said he wasn't aware of the magnitude of what happened on October 7th. And as you know, I have said the same thing. But once it was clear the magnitude of what happened, it was clear that crimes of a significant magnitude, war crimes. I know some human rights organizations will also say crimes against humanity. So crimes of a significant magnitude occurred on October 7th. So there's, as far as I could tell, no disagreement between us. I would say, however, some of the claims that were made about October 7th, for example, that Hamas had weaponized rape and sexual violence. I don't believe those claims have been borne out by the available evidence. If you allow me, Mr. Morris, you'll have your turn.
They weaponized rape.
You'll have your turn, Mr. Morris. Allow me to have mine.
Why are you lying? Why are you lying?
Okay. Pierce, you'll have to decide how to litigate at this point. Allow me my time. He will have his time. So as I said, there were crimes of a significant magnitude. Okay. Thank you so much. So on that point, there's no disagreement. The two issues as I see it between us, if you allow me, and you can, of course, disagree with me because I'm interpreting you. The two issues between us are, number one, the allocation of moral responsibility. I have said repeatedly that I refuse to condemn Hamas in the same way as my own country's abolitionists, those who oppose slavery. They refuse to condemn the largest and bloodiest slave rebellion led by Nat Turner. On the contrary, they said, speaking to white society, they said, we warned you, we warned you, we warned you. If you treat people this way, if you dehumanize them, if you exploit them, if you kill them, don't be surprised if at some point there will be a bloody, and they acknowledged, ugly slave rebellion. That is also my position on Gaza. That's number one. The second place where I believe we disagree, and here I consider it a significant disagreement, just as the first one is significant, where we secondly disagree is on your terminology. You describe what Israel has done as being disproportionate. You describe what Israel has done as being over the top. Those are your expressions. But in fact, what Israel has done is very proportionate. It's proportionate to its goal. Its goal is to achieve an ethnic cleansing by use of genocidal means. If that's your means, then what Israel has executed is proportionate. It's not over the top. It would be over the top or disproportionate if it were a war, if you were trying to inflict a military defeat on the opposing army. But that's not what's happening in Gaza. That's not what's happened since October 8th. The prime minister was very straightforward. He said, remember Amalek. Kill every man, woman, child, and other things. Or President Herzog, there are no civilians in Gaza. Or Defense Minister Gallant, we're going to prohibit all food, fuel, water, and electricity from entering Gaza.
This is pure nonsense.
That's a formula.
Pure nonsense.
That's a formula for genocide.
Okay.
Now,
Okay, let me ask you, Norman. Norman, let me ask you.
Last word.
Norman, I want to ask you one last thing too. I just want to ask you, it struck me listening to Benny Morris, who will respond in a moment. It struck me in his first response to you that he must have said a number of things in his response which you would, if you were being fair-minded, agree with. So what did you agree with him about in terms of his overview?
Well, here's the problem. Benny Morris, I'm speaking to him not as somebody who knows him personally, though we've met. Benny Morris wears many hats. He wears one hat when he's speaking in Israel or in some of his writings. But when he's speaking to a Western audience, like your program, he likes to appear to be humane, even a little bit impish, a little bit cherubic. He has a little smile and a laugh. So he is a moving target. I have asked him on several occasions. I have written more than 50 pages because I've read everything you've ever written multiple times. Just answer me in print. If I am misapprehending you, just what any scholar does, you reply. He says he will answer me. Right now, he'll probably say, oh, of course I'll answer Finkelstein, but he never will. So finally, you have to pull down the facade and expose somebody who on all political and ideological issues is indistinguishable from Daniela Weiss.
Okay. Benny Morris, respond on the wider point in a moment. But first of all, let's talk about this issue of whether Hamas weaponized rape and sexual abuse. Earlier this year, an independent Israeli investigation published details of systematic, widespread sexual violence by Hamas on October the 7th. The Civil Commission's Silence No More report says, in addition to interviews with survivors, it has more than 10,000 photographs and videos filmed by attackers. I have seen other reporting by people like Christina Lamb at the Sunday Times in the UK, who is one of the best journalists, I would argue, in the world, and certainly not partisan in any sense, reporting extensively on the weaponization of rape and sexual assault by Hamas. And yet there are people like Norman Finkelstein who are adamant it never happened. What do you say to that?
Well, as I said, it's nonsense, like most of what Finkelstein talks and says. As you say, there were witnesses who ended up alive and saw rapes. There were lots of women who were raped and murdered and looked like they'd been raped and murdered. And there were also rapes, incidentally, of Israeli hostages, women hostages, and I think at least of one case of a male hostage raped by their Hamas captors while they were held in Gaza after October 7th. So I think this is pure nonsense. I noticed that Finkelstein said that he doesn't condemn the Hamas attack on Israel because it came after a lot of Israeli oppression of the Palestinians over the years. And incidentally, that's a point I have made myself, that the Israeli occupation since 1967, and if you like, what happened in 1948, in some way explains how the Hamas did what it did on October 7th. But this doesn't justify what happened, as Finkelstein was saying, and as this priest was trying to say, who incidentally, you asked him to condemn the Hamas invasion of October 7th, and he said, I don't condone it. He didn't say, I condemn it. He didn't say what you asked him to say.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed that.
I did.
Well, that's what happened. He didn't actually condemn it. But look, Finkelstein's take is ridiculous. I don't want to get into a academic dialogue with him. I've written what I believe is true of the history, and I've also written journalistic pieces regarding various things. The use of the word genocidal may go well down well with a left-leaning or a delusioned Western academics, but that's not what happened in the Gaza Strip. There was a war there. Hamas took the first started the war, launched the war, and Israel struck back. You can say that Israel may have struck back disproportionately. That's a question which is up to, I don't know who, to decide whether it's disproportionate or not. But the Israeli counteroffensive wasn't against the population of Gaza, it was against the Hamas. The Hamas was embedded among the people there, in the houses, in the residential buildings, in underground tunnels, under hospitals, under mosques, inside mosques, etc. And for the Israeli troops and Air Force to get at the Hamas fighters, they ended up collaterally killing the people among whom they were embedded, who incidentally supported the Hamas, who are their children and brothers and fathers, etc. They're not divorced from the general Gaza population. This is an idealized version of what goes on in the Gaza Strip. But in any case, there was a war. Israel killed tens of thousands of people in its counteroffensive, but told most of the civilians in most places, get out of this district, that district, the next district, and even individual houses, called people up in their homes and said, we're about to attack this house because it contains Hamas positions or Hamas personnel. You have an hour to get out of here. We're bombing it. And they told people to leave. This isn't what people do in a genocide. Genocidaires, what they do is they actually round up people and massacre them. Israelis didn't massacre anybody, didn't line up people on the wall and shoot them. They told the civilians, move aside, we want to get to the Hamas. And a lot of people were killed in this process because the Hamas, as I said, hid among them. The word genocide is an absurdity. I've actually studied the genocide by the Muslims. Well, let me add one sentence. I've actually studied thoroughly one genocide. Not the Holocaust, the killing by Turks, the Turkish Muslims of the Christians in Turkey over the years 1894, 1924. I know exactly what a genocide looks like. You kill the men, you drive out the women, you kill the women, you rape the women, and you eventually kill as many people as you can. This isn't what happened in the Gaza Strip.
Okay, Danny Finkelstein,
go ahead, Piers.
Off the back of my interview with the Hamas spokesman.
May I respond?
Norman, I also just want to conclude the debate by looking slightly forward, because there is supposedly a deal that's been proposed by the Americans where Hamas have apparently agreed if the Israelis leave Gaza, that they will demilitarize. Do you think that is remotely likely to happen?
Well, let's start with the basics. I usually start with international law. And you'll forgive me if it sounds pedantic. And as international law has become more and more marginalized, fewer and fewer people are believing in it. But I still believe in its basic precepts. In July 2025, the International Court of Justice, the supreme legal body in the world, ruled that Israel's occupation of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem and Gaza, are illegal under international law, and Israel has to leave as quickly, as rapidly as possible. That's the first precept for me, or foundation stone for me. The ICJ, the highest.
He asked you about Hamas disarming.
Sir, Mr. Morris, this is not the
You're
West Bank.
You're not answering his question.
You have to carry on in a civilized fashion. Very difficult for you, but try. Okay? Thank you. So, the bottom line is Israel has no title to any of Gaza. Number two, under international law, there is no prohibition on a people using armed force to expel an occupying power. There is no prohibition on that. Number three, it's odd that we should discuss Hamas having to disarm. Hamas committed a crime of significant magnitude on October 7th. Israel executed a genocide in Gaza, and it continues Nonsense. In its aim of trying to expel the entire population. So why is it that Nonsense. Hamas has to disarm itself, but Israel, the genocidal state, also the state that has breached the prime precept of international law by launching an aggression, a brazen, flagrant aggression, the most brazen, the most flagrant in the modern world against Iran. Why are we talking about Hamas having to disarm? But there's one last point,
Can I say something?
Is the critical point. Yes, you've said enough. The critical point. There was no war in Gaza. Hamas is not armed. Piers, ask yourself a simple question. Gaza has been hermetically sealed for 3 years. How can it possibly have any ammunition at this point? This whole Hamas disarmament is a red herring so as to enable Israel to finish up the job it began on October 8th. And it has as its appointment Nikolai Mladenov, who gives vomit a bad name.
Okay, Benny Morris, a final word to you.
Israel wants to the Hamas disarmed because it doesn't want a repetition of what Hamas did on October 7th against Israel's civilian population in the south of the country. We don't want a repetition, and we don't want Hamas to do exactly the same thing. If you want to talk about Iran, you should mention that the Iranian regime slaughtered 30 to 40,000 of their own people, Muslims, Iranians, a few months ago. So I wouldn't call it a very innocent country or a very innocent regime. Israel is afraid that the Iranians are trying to get atomic weaponry, and they have said they want to destroy Israel and will use that weaponry to destroy Israel. And that's why Israel has launched its attacks against Iran last year and this year. And that's why America joined them, incidentally, because Trump, whatever his shortcomings, understands that atomic weaponry in the hands of fanatic Islamists in Tehran are a danger not just to Israel, but to the Middle East and perhaps the world itself.
I agree
okay,
on that point.
I'm going to leave it there. Thank you
exactly
both.
The same
I've
Donald
got to leave
Trump's.
It there, Norman. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
And just like that, we arrive at the final breaths of this week's broadcast. The slow dimming of a lantern, the quiet settling of truth after an hour that asked much of the heart. As you step back into your day, may you carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to fade, and the curiosity that keeps truth alive in a world that works tirelessly to silence it. I'm Arlene Russell, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been an honor, an hour grounded in clarity, in dignity, in a solidarity that does not evaporate when the headlines shift or when the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or cracked open a door you didn't know existed, and if you ever feel the pull to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space will always have room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To you, our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this difficult path beside us. Your presence is the quiet proof that truth still matters, that memory still matters, that resistance still matters. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on every major platform: YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Casts, Deezer, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care, stay grounded, stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is occupied land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine, from the river to the sea. Falastin Hurra.